to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We've got our wildlife music for you to listen to and get you going with Scott Craven. Scott, a wildlife ecologist, emeritus professor, as a matter of fact, in the Department of Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. And he's going to talk with us about all those garden pests that we've got. We're going to talk about the how wildlife are doing around the state with the wet weather we've had, and a whole lot more. And I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Love to hear from you. And Scott Craven, welcome back.
Hello, Larry and listeners. It's great to be back. Summer is after Man. The 4th of July. It starts to scream by, so we'll get some hot weather coming up, but things are good.
Things are good. Things are wet, have been wet across
Holy
a good
cow.
Share of the state.
It's just incredible. I was up at the our cabin over the last week or so, and I think as we were listening to the weather from the Rhinelander TV station, I think they were a solid foot above normal in terms of rain.
Oh, man.
Which is a lot of water, and there's more water in most of the lakes than I've ever seen, and things, little depressions and puddles that are usually either dry or grassy are in fact ponds and wetlands, and if anything's benefiting, the frog population and the little pond next to our cabin is incredible. There were frogs everywhere, big frogs, little frogs, all sorts of frogs, and somewhere the green frogs were just kicking and singing, so that was nice to hear. But obviously with all this water around, anything water loving, be it waterfowl or amphibians or whatnot, is probably enjoying the year a lot.
And on the other side of the spectrum, are there animals that have suffered because of the
Well, you know, sometimes you get worried about a really wet spring and all, but the rains have really come, I think, late enough so that it probably didn't disrupt some of the nesting as much as it could have had they been earlier. But June was incredibly wet. There was a lot of rain in May, but I think some things had already been nesting at that point, and we see reports, of course it's not an index of nest success, but people are excited in the North Woods about the grouse drumming counts being up substantially, and there were news reports on the TV about that. Boy, it looks like a good fall, folks, and come on up and hunt grouse and so forth. So that's good news, but again, the fact that the males were drumming doesn't necessarily convert into success of hatch and nesting if, in fact, the rains caused any problems.
Yeah. And those are rough grouse. The sharp-tailed grouse are not
doing quite as well.
No, and there's going to be no season on sharp-tailed.
Right. But that's that's a remnant population that they're trying to preserve, which I hope they do. But in terms of hunting opportunity in the North Woods and the tourist industry and the money that fall hunting brings in up there, that's primarily based on rough grouse and woodcock, and that seems to be looking up.
Yeah. Well, your garden, I understand, is under siege by rabbits, moles, raccoons, you name it.
Well, the good news is that the rain has been beneficial, and I don't, you know, maybe it was a long winter and I just don't remember, but vegetation seems to be incredibly lush and green. I mean, the woods are like rainforests, and my prairie vegetation is so thick I wouldn't dare venture into it. Although I'm sure the mosquitoes would carry me out and deposit me back on the trail. So the rain has somewhat compensated, but it's also meant really good soil moisture. And I haven't seen much mole activity for the past couple of years, but this year, the moles are doing a job on the lawn and trails. So folks may want to talk about that a little bit. But I've heard lots of reports that people were just seeing lots and lots of rabbits.
Yeah.
And if my garden is any indication of the rabbit survey results in general, then there are a lot of rabbits around. So that's been a bit of a struggle. The moles, the bird feeders have been under constant assault by raccoons, marauding bands of raccoons. And for the first time ever, I have chipmunks taking up residence in my stone block walls and Candy's Lily Garden and whatnot. Now, how the chipmunks made the trek across all those ag fields and prairie to decide to set up shop around the house, I don't know. But in any event,
they're there.
As far as small mammals are concerned and things up to rabbit size and raccoon size and even a few deer, it's been a bit of a struggle this year.
Speaking of deer, I think Jim in Rice Lake has something relating to deer. Let's go there. Hi, Jim.
Jim, we've got, like, garden deer. We live in Rice Lake, and we live in a quiet residential neighborhood, but they're eating hostas whole. They love lily buds, not once they've sprung. And we're kind of used to the early spring bear, but they come and go. But we now have this, like, docile herd of deer that are eating all of our local gardens alive. And we'd be happy to be stuck with rabbits, but we seem to have a swarm of residential deer, and I'd like to hear your guest comment on that. Thank you.
Well, maybe we can work out some sort of a trade. I've figured out how to deal with the deer, but the rabbits are very tricky. But, you know, in a neighborhood situation like that where the deer have, I assume you must, nearby there's some sort of green space or parkland or something where they're seeking refuge and all to bed down or at night. Trying to do something on a neighborhood-wide basis, there's either one of two approaches. You either have to go it alone and do whatever structural modifications you need to employ to protect your hosta plantings or lily beds or whatever, and that usually involves some type of fencing or screening or something to mechanically keep them away from it. Because at this time of year, when things are growing as rapidly as they are, most of the repellents, and with all the rain we've had, most of the repellents don't weather all that well and need constant replacement. And the new growth, of course, is unprotected because it's not treated. So the deer can usually circumvent most of that. Having said that, I had good luck the last couple of years, reasonably good luck scent-based repellent called Plant Skid, SKYDD. I think it was a Swedish product. And there are certainly others that you can try. But I think if you're just worried about a few specimens or a bed of lilies, that you kind of have to bite the bullet, so to speak, and think about some fencing. Some people have reasonable success draping bird netting over the plants that need to be protected. Chicken wire does the same thing. It's not aesthetically very pretty, but if you can get through this period that the deer are hitting them pretty hard and the plants can get to mature, you may be okay with taking the netting down later as egg fields and other things attract the deer later on.
What about the fencing? There was somebody called the show and said they were having good luck with electric fences, that they were using a solar battery kind of situation. And
there are lots of different configurations of electric fence, but the problem, of course, is electric fencing that packs a bit of a jolt in a nice, quiet suburban neighborhood, the way our caller described, is as the kids are playing tag or hide and seek, and all of a sudden they blunder into an electric fence meant to discourage deer. That can cause some neighborly relations problems that may prove to be more of a hassle than the deer management. But there certainly, if the caller or anyone else is on the edge of a park or something like that, and they're just trying to discourage the deer from coming out on one boundary, an electric fence is certainly a possibility. Along with some of the repellents, given the fact that the rain has been hard on repellents, but mechanically covering or fencing off the individual plants or beds is probably the best result. Plan B, that I mentioned there were two approaches earlier, is to attempt to gather the neighborhood. If there's a neighborhood association or, you know, just a group of like-minded individuals, the caller said a lot of people were having the same problem, then if that's the case, then sometimes the neighborhood can take a different action with fencing along a park border or eventually convincing the DNR that, hey, this deer population is out of hand. Maybe come fall, we need a special hunt in this park or whatever the case may be. So there may be options that the people can do banded together that they can't do as individuals.
Yeah. Good.
It's not an easy solve, Larry, one way or the other.
No, it isn't. Well, you can join in too, by the way, if you have a question or comment or experience to share in the wildlife area. I hope you will. The number is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. Kathy in Eau Claire emailed to say that she has heavy black plastic on the ground between raised beds in the garden. It's been there for about 3 years. Last week, something tore up about half of it and scattered it about. The next day, one large piece, about 3 by 9 feet, was completely gone. She suspects raccoons, but wonders, what did they do with the plastic?
maybe they needed to weatherize their den or whatever, but I think she's probably right about the raccoons. They're notorious for tearing things up like that, either even rolling sod, newly laid sod, rolling that back or tearing it up and just making a horrendous mess out of a lawn. But the plastic doesn't surprise me either, because under the plastic, if you roll it back, there's all sorts of nice, juicy night crawlers and grubs and other things that are hanging out there and easy pickings for the raccoons. If a whole sheet simply disappeared, I don't think the raccoons had any role in that other than probably dislodging it. And it seems like with all the storms, I mean, while I was up north, some horrendous winds went through the Madison area, and most of the state's been hit with that. I would guess that if the way my grill cover blows around the neighborhood is any indication, then I think that plastic just disappeared in a nightly wind.
In a nightly wind, or maybe it got caught on the leg or something of an animal and he dragged it off. But the wind is probably the more likely answer for sure. Well, let's go to Mike in West Bend. Hi, Mike. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a pretty heavy bow hunter, so I'm concerned about CWD. And I know that all the sportsmen, when they go to the meetings, keep telling them to get rid of baiting statewide, and now they seem to be going the opposite direction. But I noticed that in reading that the politicians said that they could get some kind of compromise where they, you know, grandma and grandpa could still see deer in your backyard, they would be more in favor of getting rid of baiting, you know, for hunting purposes. And I think too much bait is in the woods anyway. But what would you think would be reasonable, if any, that people could see it a little, and yet the heavy, heavy baiting, which goes on especially in the north, I think it's so detrimental for the herd. You know, I do think it causes problems, and I was wondering what you think would be a resolution.
Good question. Mike, thank you for calling. Scott?
Well, I'm glad you called and shared your concern about the disease. It was a problem when it was discovered. It's still a problem, and I'm fearful that it's going to remain a problem for a long time. So I agree with everything you said. I find it incredibly discouraging to see this current proposed legislation to essentially roll back the baiting and feeding bans that go into place when CWD is discovered in a county and the adjoining counties. And I think the purpose of the bill is to say, well, if we don't find any more CWD after 2 years, then fine, people can go back to baiting and feeding, which seems like a really slippery slope and to be ill-advised, to say the least. In part because if you don't look for it, you're not going to find it, and I'm not sure how much surveillance is either being done or is possible in some of those areas around the state. So, having said that, I thought a few years ago we were pretty close to seeing baiting disappear. It seemed like the pendulum had swung to the fact that the majority, not by a wide margin, but by enough of a margin, the majority of hunters had seen the light, say, hey, it's time to get rid of this practice. And, you know, once something like that goes away, assuming people abide by the changes, it kind of gets forgotten about. A new equilibrium is established, and people are hunting under different ways than sitting over a pile of bait. However, the current political climate seems to have swung in the other direction, and I'm not sure it really makes much difference anymore what the sportsmen think, whether it's about baiting or license increases or tags or assorted other things. Decisions are being made in other ways for the sportspersons. So if you asked me what, I guess you did, what should we do about this? Well, ordinarily I would have said, well, we need to have some impact on the political process and eventually see a law put in place that ends baiting. I find it hard personally to separate baiting from feeding, recreational feeding, the way you described it. I understand that it's popular, especially in some parts of the state. And it's kind of cool to see those deer piled up out in the backyard while you're having dinner. But the reality is that whether the intent is recreational feeding for viewing purposes or baiting for hunting purposes, the bottom line is it's still food in the environment, which is congregating deer in close proximity and presumably facilitating the transmission or spread of CWD, among other things. So I'm thinking that someday the end of those practices would, in the long run, be beneficial. But I don't see it happening anytime soon. And you have to remember that it is a very difficult thing to enforce.
Yeah.
It's one of those things like, I think what has to happen is that somehow the ethic or mindset of the people themselves, from the recreational feeders to the baiters, swings to the same type of mindset that somehow musky fishermen now
yeah.
have.
Mm-hmm.
That, hey, catch and release is the way to go. And all of a sudden, there's social pressure and peer pressure that I caught a muskie, but I'm going to put it back, and somebody else can catch it, or you might catch it again. And that mindset has been very beneficial to the muskie fishery and to some other fisheries. I think, I'm trying to remember, on the back of the regulations pamphlet, the statistics for fishing, I think it said something like there were 85 or 90 million fish caught a year in Wisconsin, but only 34 million, about a third of them, are kept. So a lot of fish are being put back. If that kind of a mindset could eventually permeate the world of deer feeding and baiting, and people just come to grips with the fact that, this isn't really the best thing to do, so we'll have to be satisfied with seeing a few deer out on the edge of the field at night or wandering through the yard. As far as hunting's concerned, it's not necessary to kill deer. Then maybe things will get better. But for now, the situation doesn't look so great.
Scott Craven, Emeritus Professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and UW Extension, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn and her guests take a look at 50 years of Summerfest. That's at 2 o'clock today. Right now, taking a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll go right back to our phones and take a call from Jim in Camp Douglas. Jim, hi. Thank you for calling.
Okay, yeah. Back to that chipmunk scenario.
Yeah.
I had about five of them move in close to my home, and they ended up leaving for whatever reason. And I did some research on them, and what I understand is they're really not something that you want around because of the parasites and the digging holes next to the basement foundation, and water can travel in that way. Is that something I should be concerned about if they do come back, or are they kind of fun and okay to have around?
Yeah. They're cute little animals. They're pretty little small mammals. They're fun to watch. They're very active. They're out during the day. You know, if the kids start throwing them a peanut or whatnot, you can get them to the point where they'll they will take a peanut out of your fingers, literally. You have to be a little careful. I mean,
yeah.
I remember the squirrel family. They can certainly bite, and you don't want a child, you know, grabbing one or trying to pet one. But that notwithstanding, they have some redeeming features that people enjoy. On the flip side, as you described, Several houses back, I had quite a concentration of them in the rock walls along my driveway, and holy mackerel, they were excavating so much dirt that the wall was subsiding and rocks were tumbling down and all of my creeping phlox were dug out and on the pavement, and they chewed the corners of the garage door seal off so that they could get into the garage and get at the dog food that we had in there and a few other things. So they can be reasonably destructive. Now, on the flip side, the good news is they're pretty easy to catch in a small live trap and relocate them, assuming you do that correctly. There are other ways to get rid of them as well. But if chipmunks are one of those things that if there's just a pair of them or a couple of them and they're not really causing a problem that you can see or detect, then, hey, yeah, and enjoy them for what they are. They're something to watch around the yard. If they start to cause difficulty with the garage or a rock wall or whatever, then you can deal with that appropriately if that time arrives.
There we go. On to Gene now in Almond. Gene, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. We have hostas, and the deer don't seem to hit them, and they walk right by them. Any idea about that? And I don't mean to be flippant, but people who have trouble with deer and rabbits ought to become predators. Now, that's not always an available alternative when you live in the city, but here in the Stevens Point Plover area, they control their deer herd. They have sharpshooters, I guess, for want of a better word, that come in and cull deer. And otherwise, for people who are out in the country, encourage predators. We live southeast of Stevens Point, certainly not in the wilderness area, and we have fishers, coyotes, fox, and the occasional wolf and bear. And I don't shoot those things or trap them. If you've got problems with plantings, encourage the predators that are going to eat what's eating your stuff.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Sometimes predators certainly can help. Sometimes they can't do the job alone, and human intervention through acting like a predator, as you describe, in other words, hunting or removing some of these animals in legal and lethal ways, is another alternative. But, some people have very different feelings about how to approach that. So certainly a possibility as far as the hostas being ignored by the deer. I have the same situation. I have a number of varieties of hostas around the yard. I know the deer walk through the yard because I find their tracks, and they mowed my newly planted strawberries down the other night, ignored the hostas completely. And I cannot explain that other than the fact that
they like the strawberries better.
Deer are in some ways like people, and there are some things they just like better, or for individual deer they may not like at all. And with as much vegetation as is around the landscape as it is now because of all the rain and good growing conditions, the deer have a lot of options right now.
Yeah.
Things might change a little bit come fall or early winter. But for now, if they're leaving your hostas alone, don't rock the boat.
Don't rock the boat. Thanks a lot for calling, Gene. Appreciate it. And Dick in Viroqua up next. Dick, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. We bought a piece of property up north at Black River Falls, and we were told that a gentleman is baiting bears in the area that we do some walking in. How dangerous is it for us to be walking in that kind of region? I'm not exactly sure where the bait is, but is bear baiting legal year-round, or...?
No, I didn't think it was, although I think that just within the last year or two, the legislature extended the time period. Maybe I'm thinking about dog training. I could be confused, but either the period by which dogs could be trained on bears, or the baiting interval has been examined and I think modified in the past couple of years. So the first thing to do is either through the DNR website, and there's a long section about bear hunting and regulations. You can pin that down as to just when bear baiting is legal and when it isn't. If the baiting is occurring at a time period when it's not legal, then that's something you report to the local conservation officer, and that'll be the end of that. I thought that the baits had to be... Do they have to be identified, Larry, as to...
I think so.
I thought there was something that had to be posted or whatnot. Is this occurring on your property or just on an area you recreate on?
The area that we recreate on is public property.
Okay. Well... again, getting back to your original case, at the time of year leading up to the fall bear season, which starts in September, bear baits are across northern Wisconsin. I can't imagine that you could find many 80-acre sections of land that may not have a bear bait on them somewhere. It's a pretty common practice. So avoiding them is not easy. In terms of the actual risk or hazard to you, I guess I wouldn't be overly concerned about it. You should always be alert. And if there's bears in the area or you know where, I would try and find out where the bait stations are and maybe skirt them. But if you're approaching an area where you know there's baiting, you know, just make a little more noise than usual, and the odds are way in favor of the bear, if there's one around at all, being long gone before you actually get near the bait.
Yeah, unless there's you're a bear with cubs.
Yeah. So, I mean, living in bear country, you should be aware of generally how bears behave, when they're active, you know, where the higher densities are, and then just go about your business. The reality is there are a lot of people in northern Wisconsin. There are a lot of bears in northern Wisconsin, and incidents between bears and people are pretty rare.
Yeah, there we go. Good luck. Thank you. So, and there's some information on the DNR website about what you've just discussed as well.
Right. There's a brochure called Living with Black Bears,
yep,
available from, I think, USDA and other such references that will tell you exactly how to behave when you're in bear country and how to behave when you actually encounter a bear.
Yep.
And there you go.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Jane in Maquantico, your turn now. Hi, Jane.
I'll bet that's me, and I'm in Muskego.
Oh, Muskego, sorry.
I don't think I have to tell you that this is a year when the mosquitoes are really feasting on us warm-blooded mammals. And I wondered if Scott has any suggestions about how to repel mosquitoes from to a great enough distance so that they don't fly onto my deck.
No.
Well, oh, boy.
On your deck, there is one way and that I've found that works really well, and that is I've got one of these box fans.
A fan, yep.
And when we go out on the porch, I turn on the box fan, and that they're not good flyers, as I'm sure Scott will tell you, and we have many fewer problems when we have that fan going.
We do the same thing at the cabin. If we're up, the deck's elevated a bit, and if we're out there having dinner and there's mosquitoes around, a box fan really does a good job. Two box fans would probably be twice as good.
Better, yeah.
But Phil Pelletier used to describe them, as Larry said, as very weak flyers, and it doesn't take much of a breeze to just push them out of the way. So that's a harmless, no pesticide, no hassle approach to the whole thing. There are also lots of fogging tools with various types of fog that can essentially smoke out an area if you're getting ready for a campfire or an evening cookout or something like that and just want to clear the area. I'm trying to think of what my son-in-law found a recipe on, I think it was on YouTube the other day, that he saved to his phone because he wanted to try it. And I want to say it used mint mouthwash as the primary ingredient. It was all relatively innocuous things mixed together, and the reviews that were posted said, "Oh, this was fantastic. We mixed it up and sprayed it around the yard. Man, the mosquitoes, boom, they were gone." Well, I don't know about that, but there are some
they'll
things.
They'll blow back in.
There are some commercial things as well as some home remedies that might help you up a little, out a little bit. But my tactic this morning, I had a little hoeing to do in the garden, and I tried that for about 5 minutes. I said, nuts to this. And I went back inside, and that solved the problem completely.
But the box fans are really a good non, you know.
You have given me one really good suggestion, that the box fans on the deck that can be turned on just when needed. That doesn't, you mentioned fogging. Can you do that after the mosquitoes start? Or is that too late?
Well, it's a temporary solution.
Yeah.
So it's just designed to kind of create a mosquito-free zone for, you know, at best an evening around the campfire. And that
That's at best
is pretty liberal. So that's a short-term solution for a specific task.
In the meantime, make sure that if you've got any tires or any standing water that's around your area, get rid of it. And that can help a little bit. At least it's going to discourage breeding. Even my bird feeder, I make sure the water on that gets changed every couple of days, because I forget what the gestation period is for eggs. I think it's like 7 days, isn't it?
It doesn't take very long.
So I even that bit of water I try to get rid of or replace. Let's put it that way. So that's something else to.
Is it possible to buy a fogger in a spray can so that it? It can be done on those nights when we can get outdoors and just spray around after the bees have gone to bed and before the mosquitoes have attacked full-fledged?
I would assume
there must be
fogging stuff available in cans like wasp spray and whatnot, but most of the ones I'm familiar with operate with a little gas canister that powers them, and then you mix up the fogging solution, put it in a reservoir, and then it generates the smoke or fog that's sprayed around. So
yeah,
I think if you go to a big garden center or the outdoor section of one of the big box stores, they'll have a number of options for you to choose from.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Lee in Williams Bay, it is your turn. Hi, Lee.
Hello, Larry. Hello, Scott.
Hello.
I'm enjoying the program as usual. I put in a picket fence last year, and real nice fence, but I've noticed like in February or March, I looked out and all the tops of the pickets have been chewed on. I'm an avid bird feeder, so of course I get chipmunks and squirrels. And I do get the occasional deer, but they're chewing away at the tops of my picket, and it's kind of unsightly. And I wondered if Scott had any ideas about what I could put on those pickets that would be, I'm an environmentalist, I don't want to put anything on that would hurt another creature. And so if he had any ideas, I'll listen off air, okay?
All right, thanks for calling. There are some solutions.
Yeah, I mean, just the fact that the squirrels are chewing on them is no surprise. They're rodents, and their incisor teeth grow continuously, so they chew on stuff all the time just to keep those teeth worn down. And it's also possible that if those pickets are treated with whatever, sometimes the treatment is chemically attractive to the squirrels as well, and they'll chew them down. But I think in this case, there are two options. One is some type of a chemical solution. There are hot sauce-based repellents that are sometimes used as additives to bird feed and around bird feeders to deter squirrels. The active ingredient in hot sauce is a chemical called capsaicin. And you can get products with that in it at garden centers, and that sprayed or painted on top of the pickets might do the job. But I think depending on how much fencing you have, some type of mechanical little cap would be easily applied. That could be as simple as foil. It could be a strip of sheet metal, or probably not plastic, but sheet metal that would be just bent over the top of the picket and tacked on. You know, Larry, did you mention tar paper? No, I heard you.
Oh, I was thinking in terms of the capsaicin sauce.
Okay.
As an easy beginning, you could try that out and see if it works. I know people have had luck with it.
But where you have, say, a fence post that birds perch on, especially along the lakeshore or whatever, there are products that will fit on, say, a 4x4 or something like that, that are impermeable to chewing and too slippery for a bird to sit on. So I think there are probably ways you can either mechanically treat the pickets or try the capsaicin or whatever other repellent the garden centers might recommend.
And let's turn to Tom in Brookfield next. Tom, it's your turn. Hi.
Hey, good morning, guys. How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Hey, I'm calling in regards to that lady with the problem with the mosquitoes on her deck.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I have used a product. There's a couple products on the market. Cutters makes one. Off makes one. And I used to have some serious problems with mosquitoes in my yard. I got an acre and all surrounded by woods. And it's called, I think, it's like a backyard control. You put it on the garden hose.
Go over your
whole lawn. You can do your flowers. You can do your the base of your house. Everything, and it works very, very well.
Okay.
Well, another type of spray.
That can
does
work.
The same thing as fogging.
Yeah.
I guess, so
thanks, Tom. You. Appreciate it.
It's supposed to last about a month, even if it rains.
Oh. Okay. Well, something to consider.
Going to get some on the way home.
Let's go to Joe in Oshkosh next. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I got a question about an animal I saw at work, and I work right in the middle of the city. It's 8:30 in the morning, broad daylight, and I see this black thing going across the street. Okay, I didn't get a real good look at it, and it was several houses away, but it was, you know, a lot bigger than a squirrel, and it had a big black bushy tail, and I couldn't figure it out. So I went home, I looked at my book, and the only thing I could see that it could be would be either a marten or a fisher. And I'm kind of wondering what your thought of that is. And it didn't walk in a straight line like a dog or a fox would walk. You know, it kind of went up and down as it crossed the road.
So it was loping a little bit. Okay.
Ungulating.
Any water anywhere near you?
Well, there's tons of water all around. You know, but with this ran not right in this spot. It's about four blocks from the Fox River.
Okay.
You know, and a mile from Lake Winnebago.
Yeah.
Well, all right. So there are four possibilities. So I'll add a couple to your list. You had marten and fisher. I'm going to add mink and woodchuck. Okay. Now the we'll rule out the marten. They're an endangered species, only found in a couple pockets of population up in the northern part of the state. That would be a moonshot to see the marten, and they're a bit smaller than some of the other animals you describe. The fisher's kind of a long shot too, but they have been spreading around the state, and the size and the coloration and the tail seem reasonable. But would you describe it as kind of a chunky animal or kind of long and cylindrical?
No, it was kind of chunky. And I thought woodchuck right away until I saw the tail, because we've had woodchucks in our backyard. They have kind of a shorter tail. Well, this is kind of a big black bushy tail, you know. So right away I ruled that out. And I looked in my book, I saw mink, and they're pretty small compared to this. And I don't think they're black. But,
well, they can be jet black because some of them are. I picked up a beautiful jet black one in the road that had been hit by a car a few years ago, because there are a lot of mink operations around farms, and black is one of the colors that's bred. So and a big male mink can be a pretty sizable animal. So that's one possibility. The woodchuck really would have been pretty rotund looking, it sounds like, and they're usually kind of a grizzled, lighter brown. But they do have a pretty good-sized dark tail, or can. And then the fisher, of course, is kind of runs with a loping, hunchbacked gait, which fits with what you described. But they have a much longer tail, much longer and darker tail than either of the other two animals. So...
Couldn't rule out a Fisher.
We learned a long time ago on this program and in other things I did for years to never say never about any of these things. And so I guess the Fisher is a possibility. By odds, mink or woodchuck are more likely. But
I'm from Antigo. I've seen Fishers up there, and I just didn't think they were down in this part of the state. You know?
Well, they've gotten down all over the southwestern and southern part of the state. Not abundantly, but they are seen with some regularity. So,
all right. There you go. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. Scott Craven, Wildlife Ecologist, our guest today here on the Ideas Network. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. If you've got a wildlife photo, we'd love to see that up on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. Let's go to Iris in Mequon next. Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I have kind of an unusual question, but so all the time I'm driving down this Highway 41, and I come across deer laying all over the place on this highway. I mean, you know, throughout, intermittently. I'm just wondering, who's the entity or person in charge of picking up the deer? And then, I mean, there's a I think, rescue in Sharon, Wisconsin that have tigers and lions, and I mean, has it ever been considered to maybe give these dead animals, the carcass, over to these guys? I mean, I'm sure they could use it to feed these lions that they're fostering or sheltering.
Well, I think that latter alternative has been explored, and I remember on the program we at one point were reaching out to hunters and others that deer organs, particularly hearts, were extremely useful for rehabilitating injured eagles and other raptors and whatnot. And boy, they got a great response to that. As far as the road kills are concerned, they rather quickly get to the point out on a hot highway that they might not be particularly attractive or useful for that purpose. And in terms of the basic question, who picks them up? I don't think anybody picks them up.
Not anymore.
It used to be pretty common, and I think there were, each county had a contractor, which was one of the reasons they were often spray painted, so they didn't get double counted or they went on the pickup list, and they disappeared. But at this point, at least as I drive north on Highway 39, you know, the same carcass is there going up, the same carcass is there coming back, but there's a little less of it, and eventually they get, you know, knocked off into the ditch or the scavengers clean them up. But I think that routine pickup became a financial burden on the counties and I'm kind of going by guessing by golly here, but I think it's largely been abandoned. And it used to be a county responsibility. And, of course, people who hit the deer, if they're inclined to want the carcass themselves, either to donate to, you know, someone who can feed it to something or use the meat, or they want the meat, that can still be done, but that requires a phone call and authorization from either the county sheriff or the DNR, and any DNR service center could tell a motorist in that position who to actually get the permission from. But I have a feeling that routine pickup is pretty much gone by the boards.
Yep. I think you're exactly right. There you go, Iris. Thanks so much for calling. Scott, bats. You know, we've got, we've talked, not even that far back on the show, I had some DNR folks on talking about white nose syndrome and how pervasive it's become. You had some common thoughts on it.
We've talked about it for a long time on the program. After white nose was discovered in 2006, and the DNR here and the bat team was frantically taking every step they could think of conceivable to slow the arrival or to prevent it from happening. But I think everybody deep down knew it was inevitable, and it was finally discovered, I think, in 2014. In Grant County, and is now, the last article I saw said that it's spread to at least 60 other locations across the state and will soon do what it's going to do. and it's been very disruptive of the cave bat populations. What I was curious about, the listeners over the years, we've had many, many calls about people with bats in attics and cabins and barns and under the eaves and under the shutters and all sorts of places. I'm kind of curious. This is a you know, call your audience kind of question. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of curious if people who have had chronic bat problems in cabins, homes, barns, sheds, whatever, have seen any
decline
in that problem because of this issue. And I'm going on a, there was a recent article in the paper that Devil's Lake State Park had essentially canceled their educational bat programs because there weren't enough bats to deal with anymore. And we just finished our summer field course up at Kemp Station on Lake Tomahawk in Minocqua Woodruff. And, you know, for the 20 years we've been doing that, there are always bats in the, you know, in the boathouse and in a couple of the buildings. We could always get bats to show the students. Not a bat to be seen this year. So, I was just, the one issue is a little more awareness and education that, this disease that we feared was going to get here did get here and now seems to be having a negative effect on our bat populations. And I'm sort of curious if that's borne out by our listeners' own experiences. So,
yeah,
give us a call.
Joan in Hayward, let's turn to you next. Hi, Joan. Thanks for calling.
And good morning. My name is Joan. I live in Hayward, Wisconsin, and we have about 6 acres here. And our neighbor's cats have decided to use our outbuildings as their litter box. Do you have any potential natural or ideas on repelling them?
That's a challenging problem. I, as anyone who's listened to the program for a long time, I have a pretty strong personal feelings about free-ranging cats. So it's pretty clear where I stand on the matter. I think the responsibility for cats lies with the neighbors. Have you talked to the neighbors about this, that you don't like it?
We're going to start our communication, and we were thinking that we could try mothballs first.
Well, yes, you can. That would be, I mean, the next step is to try something relatively non-invasive, moth flakes, primarily naphthalene-based mothballs rather than paradichlorobenzene, or you can try either one, but naphthalene seems to be more offensive to mammals, and the flakes are easier to spread. But realize that they volatilize or evaporate pretty quickly, so you're going to have to keep reapplying them. But that's a good, easy starting point. The smell of ammonia is also offensive. And, of course, you said they were getting into a shed?
Yeah, we have a shed, and especially in the wintertime when the ground is frozen. It's probably their only soft earth place for them to use as a litter box.
But is it possible to close it, screen it, or make
really.
It inaccessible? Not really. It's in kind of porous, to say.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
It's a sandy air.
All right, so that's, well, if you can't physically prevent the access, then the kinds of repellents that you're talking about are worth trying.
I agree that control of the cats in free range is a major issue for discussion, though.
Yes, and hopefully we don't go there today because that will take the rest of the program. But I guess I'd start with the repellents that may discourage the cats but not harm them. But I think it's inevitable that you're going to have to open a channel of communication to the neighbors, say, hey, come on, your cats are causing us some problems over here. They're making a mess in our shed or whatever. Is there anything you can or would do about it? And then see where that takes things as well.
Yeah.
But good luck.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We've got a trip coming up.
Yes. Excellent.
That I wanted to plug in here to Yellowstone.
Well, as you know, Larry, in the couple of minutes I have here, for the last few years I've been helping with the Natural Resources Foundation in co-hosting or leading a couple of tours. We went to Isle Royale a couple of years ago, and there were a number of NPR or WPR listeners on that. Last year we had a fantastic trip down to the Everglades in February. That was great. And this coming winter, the trip that we're going to be taking is to Yellowstone National Park in winter. Now, lots of people have been to Yellowstone, but not many people have been in there in the winter. So this trip is using the snow coaches going in from the north end from Mammoth Hot Springs into the Old Faithful area. The trip will run, I think, 6 days total. We're spending 2 or 3 days in at the Snow Lodge at Old Faithful in the park doing wildlife tours and seeing the thermal feature, geothermal features and whatnot. Trip will meet in Bozeman. Transfer down to the Mammoth Hot Springs Hotel, and then eventually into the park. And there'll be lots of tours and talks and so forth associated with this. So this particular trip is going to run February 26th to March 4th. It's being offered through the Natural Resources Foundation, so it's a fundraiser for the foundation itself, in addition to the actual trip and what people will get out of that. If anybody's interested in checking this out, it's a fairly small group that's going. And you can go to wisconservation.org, the Natural Resources Foundation website, and do the appropriate clicking and looking around, and you'll get to it. Or you could probably call the office and talk with Michelle. Or the trip is going to be organized through Door County Tours and a good friend of mine who I've worked with for a long time. And you could also reach him through email about the trip, doorcountypaul@gmail.com. So there's several ways, but I recommend the wisconservation.org website, and I think it's going to be a pretty fun trip.
Oh, that should be, and you're going to be there.
Yep.
You'll be there.
I'll be there.
Jill, maybe
Paul.
We can, Jill Nadeau, our producer, is working feverishly in there. Maybe we can put that Wisconservation link up on our website, on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. So If you need to be reminded about it a half hour later from now,
okay.
We'll just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and you'll find it there. She'll post it up for us. Scott Craven, our guest today. Scott, Emeritus Professor, a UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Got some cool things up on our Facebook page as well, so take a look there. Back after the news. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Scott Craven, talking the world of wildlife. Scott, an Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Great to have him along. Join in at 800-642-1234. And you should visit our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. There are lots of great wildlife photos up right now from everything from pileated woodpeckers to captured chipmunks to deer, lots of great photos. Wallace in Weyerhaeuser has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Wallace.
Hi, Larry and Scott. Please bear with me. First of all, Larry, I could just see you slinging the big plugs after those miniature railroad ties that follow it.
I love doing that.
Yes, you bet. Me too. When that bug gets you, it's bad. Okay. Back to my question. Here a number of years ago, before this Muskie Incorporated got, you know, a real movement?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I was dairying, and of course that's 24/7 and 14 days, you know, 14 hours. So, but I still joined it because my brother and I were fishing on a Muskie Lake, and he said, well, we won't go on the weekend. We'll wait till Monday because they have a tournament, you know. So, okay. We went fishing, and that day we found 3 dead muskies. And we were aware of the muskie tournament, so both of us joined the Muskies Incorporated. And I stuck with them for 6 years, and it was a constant battle. I tried to stop that. I have no qualms at all about voicing my opinion against these tournaments. Muskie are tournament, and I'd like your... and your guest opinion.
Okay, so...
Well, I'm going to defer to the former president of Muskies, Inc., which I think was the case.
International Muskie Association.
The International Muskie Association. And Larry's a muskie fisherman, and I'm not. So...
I think You know, you're talking a little bit, Wallace, about some years back, but I think one of the things that those organizations have done is to really do some good educating on catch and release and how to release a muskie properly in the water. And the kind of netting that you use, the cradle nets, work wonderful and are probably the best kind of net to use to land a muskie. Because they'll do the least amount of harm. Sometimes they're released right in the water, depending on the fish. You carry a pliers that can cut the hook, and just all you have to do is replace the hook, and that hook is quickly dissolved by the muskie, you know, sort of by what goes on chemically in the water and with the fish. So I think I'm not as anti-tournament as I used to be, mostly because I think the rate of catch and release, the rate of fish surviving that is very, very high. So those are my thoughts on that. There are other tournaments that I think the hardest part is if you are out fishing during a tournament. There can be a lot of boats on the water, and if you're not part of that tournament and you're trying to fish, it can be really can be an issue. And I've been in those situations myself, and I've actually fished in the World Championships myself in the Manitouish Waters area, mind you, not with any luck. But the fish that were caught were all released, and I was pretty confident that they were going to survive, probably 99% at least. So, Scott, anything on just on bass or any of the other kinds of tournaments that go on out there?
You know, I share the concern about, you know, fish being caught essentially in a tournament context and then released. Some people have ethical arguments with that, but. You know, most newer boats with really well-constructed live wells or yeah. the type of nets that are available now with the rubber mesh like you described, if people know what they're doing, the survival rate is pretty high.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, Wallace. We're going to go to Francesca, who is in Madison and has a comment. Let's go there. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry and Scott. This is Francesca, and I just wanted to convey a story. On Sunday, I was driving from Minneapolis to Madison on a 94, and I saw this huge, massive body on the side of the road, and it was clear that it was a bear, and it was dead. And it seemed like someone had also noted it, too, because there was that yellow tape that it kind of wrapped in. And also, as I drove by, there was a pretty strong odor. And so I was just curious, is that pretty uncommon? Because I had never seen that before.
Well, bears do get hit by vehicles, but I guess now that I think about it, other than the fact that I ran over one in Manitoba many, many years ago that someone in front of me had actually hit. That's the only road-killed bear I guess I can think of in, you know, 30 years of roaming around. So they do get hit, but it is not common. And because it isn't common, there may be more of a premium on people either calling them in or attempting to salvage them or something when they do get hit.
Yeah.
So,
and just to go along with that, Jill did some digging around on deer removal, and the Department of Transportation says, you know what the Department of Transportation says? I have no idea because my screen just went black.
Well, I can read it here. It says...
Well, hold on a second. You need to get you by a microphone.
Okay. Transportation says as of March... Here's another microphone. As of March 1st, 2016, the new car kill deer removal, so this is pretty recent, and disposal process has changed. Counties are responsible for removing deer carcasses on county highways. Municipalities are responsible for removing deer carcasses on their local roads. And the DNR continues. Can you scroll that down, Larry?
I can now because I got my screen back.
Okay. The DNR, where is it? And the DNR continues to coordinate disposal services on interstate, U.S., and state highways. So it's a multi-jurisdictional approach to removing the deer, and it makes me a little nervous with so many people involved that I guess I'm not terribly surprised they seem to sit around for a long time. So
yeah,
there you have it.
And probably they're more likely to be picked up, I guess, if somebody would call, if somebody calls, likely.
Right.
They're then made aware.
At least there's a process.
Yeah, at least there's a process. Thank you, Francesca. Appreciate your call. And I now am turning to Susan in Menominee, Wisconsin. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am Menominee, 30 miles north of Menominee, Michigan. Marinette.
Okay.
And I know this is not fair to try to describe a bird and ask for help identifying it. It was very strange. I live on a marsh, and this huge bird landed in a tree. I thought it was an eagle. It didn't have trouble landing like some of the herons do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It landed, and I finally put the binoculars on it because I thought it just doesn't quite look like an eagle. It had a very, very long beak. It was big. It had, like, I'd say the last half of its wings were black. Its body was more of a brown, but it seemed to have a white spot on its head. And it sat in the tree, you know, looking over the marsh. And then when it flew, it looked like a crane type of bird. I just want help.
And when you say the beak was long, was the beak hooked or was, you know, it sort of a hook appearance to it, or was it a straight bill?
I had the impression it was more of a straight. I looked in my bird book, and I just saw nothing that reminded me of it. I thought if you just kind of give me an idea, like what types of birds might look like that, I could pursue.
But you're sure it wasn't a great blue heron?
No, I'm positive. I've had white egrets. I have green herons. I've got great blue herons. I've never seen anything like this thing.
Was it as big as a great blue heron?
Yes.
Wow.
Hmm.
And black. Hey.
long legs when it flew. Were the legs dragging out behind it or folded up, or could you tell?
I could not tell. I was the impression it didn't have long legs because it latched onto the kind of topish of the tree quite easily, you know, where the herons, they kind of struggle to get a hold and they kind of flop around for a little while. This thing landed like an eagle, like it, you know, it seemed like it was easy for it to perch.
Huh. Oh, my goodness.
There aren't that many big birds with straight heron-like bills that aren't herons.
Yeah, I know.
I'm just trying to think of something that could have, you know, blown up from the south, all the stuff we were seeing
in
the southern marshes.
When I looked in my bird book, a wood stork is the only thing that really reminded me at all of it, and that was like in the Florida range.
Yeah, and they're, you know, they're really light, light colored, and the bill is really pretty heavy.
They have a little trouble when they land,
pretty
too.
Pretty massive bill. But, I mean, you seem to know your local marsh birds pretty well, so I guess I would tend to lean on something that may have blown in from somewhere else, but I don't know about wood stork.
I don't think it was. I'm just saying that's, you know, the thing that I saw that most reminded me of it. And it had quite a heavy, long beak when I was watching it. You know, it would turn, and that beak would really show up. It was, you know, turning its head, kind of sat up there just like the eagles do, you know, looking out and over and... thank you.
I'm trying to think.
Well, thanks for nothing, you should say.
I can't think of what it might be.
Must have been bigger than a cormorant.
Yes, definitely. Like I said, I thought
what about a turkey vulture?
No, wasn't definitely. No, it had a very, if I could say anything about it, is that beak was just huge.
Oh. So it wasn't a pelican.
Yeah,
by,
I was just going to say it wasn't a pelican.
A piebald, you know, or something?
Yeah, it reminded me. That would be the next thing I would say it reminded me of was a pelican. But it was not. I'm pretty sure it was not.
I mean, the brown fits and the shorter legs and the huge bill and whatnot.
Yeah.
Do they, like I'd say at least the latter half of the wings were black, both above and underneath. Does that fit the marking of a pelican?
Well, not a brown pelican, but a white pelican.
Yeah.
But a white pelican's white, so I don't know about the juveniles.
A piebald, maybe.
I don't know. There's all sorts of weird plumages and variations and whatnot. So I don't know. We may have to chalk this, unless a listener calls in our last 10 minutes here with a
another
really brilliant
guess.
Solution. I don't know what to say.
My advice is, if you can get a photo of it, if it lands again and you can get a photo of it, that would resolve the, hopefully resolve the problem. Wish we could help, but I think we're out of luck on that one. For now, Susan, thanks for calling.
We do have some bat information.
Yeah, we got Jeff in Fox Lake has something about bats for us. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning, gentlemen. Yes, I got an active dairy farm here, and I always have a ton of barn swallows. And up till 2 years ago, I always had one pair of bats. They would nest in a hay barn, and I knew that they nested there. Whether or not they raised young or not, I can't say for sure, but they'd have a pile of guano and the bales beneath it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was entertaining to watch them in the evening when they come out. And the past 2 years, all I've had was a lone bat would come in the spring, or late spring when you would, you know, I'd be looking for them. It's after the swallows come. And I see them for a couple nights, and then I say that he don't stick around either. So they definitely, and otherwise, as long as I can remember, and I've been here, you know, my whole life, we've always had a good population of bats. You know, we never did anything to hurt them or to try and move their nest. They never put it where there was trouble. It was either in the corn crib roof, which was a double roof, or in the hay mow, and I always leave a door open so they get in and out. Past 2 years, nothing. That one, and that's it. And it is really saddening to know that that their population is gone, because they're awful useful as far as I'm concerned.
Well, all very well said, Jeff, and it is, as you stated, a sad situation. We're gradually assembling some data points here, but what you said wasn't unexpected, but it is discouraging now that disease is apparently taking hold in Wisconsin.
The only other comment I got, the swallows seem to have taken over. Whether there's more insects available, I have more barn swallows than ever before nesting in that barn. And while it's a long open barn all this time of year, but and they do their job. There is not mosquitoes around the buildings. If you get a little ways away, there's mosquitoes, but not close up by the buildings. So
very cool. Thanks, Jeff. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. A caller said that bear that the person thought she'd seen a bear dead along the road, apparently the caller was in the same area, and it was a young black Angus cow that could have been the...
Oh. That seems suspicious that a dead cow
would still be there. Yeah.
Well, I suppose a big black animal could easily have been... You wouldn't have expected a cow, but...
Yeah.
I don't know, a cow head and a bear's head. Well... Who knows? That's interesting, though, that two people would have seen two similar large black animals. But I noticed there was one comment on the, maybe it was on the Facebook page, about a question about, we talked about relocating chipmunks, and the question was, is that legal?
Yes.
And I guess that requires a little clarification. Technically speaking, or legally speaking, all the stuff you might catch in a live trap in your backyard, be it raccoon, possum, squirrel, rabbit, whatever, cannot and should not just be hauled out into the countryside to the first available farm, green field, or whatever else,
right,
and released. Legally, you're supposed to have permission of the private landowner to release animals like that, or permission from the property manager in the case of public properties like DNR state wildlife areas, parks, or things like that. So, no, you're not supposed to just haul this stuff out and let it go where you think it will be happy, because the reality is there are staggering numbers of animals trapped in people's backyards that just get dumped out somewhere, and the first open space like an arboretum or a park is usually the beneficiary in quotes of all of these animals that continue to go about their pestiferous ways. It is not a good situation. So
back to Facebook for a minute. There's Doug sent a photo of a snake, wonders if it's a corn snake. Found it in Bayfield, or, you know, came upon it in Bayfield, the golf course there. And it kind of looks like it might, he wonders if it's a corn snake. And Scott,
well,
what do you
I'm trying
think?
To get back to my microphone here. I when I saw it from a distance and saw the light kind of golden brown color, I thought, oh, that's probably an escaped corn snake. And I suppose it could be. But as I look at it closely, it also may be a recently shed fox snake. I can't see the head very well, but fox snakes, or pine snakes as most people call them, are very common and in that area. And a recently shed or very clean snake that may have come out of the water or just shed its skin. It has a bright new skin. The belly coloration looks right, and the other markings look right. I just can't see the top of the head very well, but I think it's far more likely that it's a newly shed fox snake than
that's
snake.
A good observation, Scott. Bill emailed to say he lives in Madison. He has an eagle's nest in his backyard with two eaglets. He's going to send us a photo on Facebook, so I'm looking forward to seeing that right in Madison.
That's pretty cool. I think we're almost to the point now where every county in Wisconsin now has actively nesting eagles. There may be one or two left, but that's about it. They've become quite common, considering we almost lost them.
And John in Green Bay, I'm talking about that bird we were trying to identify earlier, says the mystery bird may be an American bittern.
The caller seemed to know her marsh birds pretty well, and a bittern is not, you know, nearly the stature of a great blue heron, so I don't know.
And there's one more here that I wanted to get to. This was... I'm finding it. Gary and Rhinelander emailed to say a maintenance crew at Rhinelander Oneida County Airport shot and killed a pair of sandhill cranes and their two youngsters on the airport property. To him, this is a very sad scene. He's wondering what legal rights are there for that. I assume the cranes were posing a hazard to the aircraft.
Well, I assume that was the rationale for it. And airports do have some latitude because of public safety issues and whatnot, but I still think that would be something that would have to go through, especially there. Was that Rhinelander?
Yes.
Yeah, because the USDA Wildlife Services office is right there in Rhinelander, and they often handle airport issues all around the country with gulls and geese and other such things, and I would think that would have had to have gone through them. I don't know that the maintenance people would have had the latitude to just do that unilaterally, but I don't know for sure.
I would bet that they probably would have been contacting those folks.
Yep.
Well, you're off to Alaska tomorrow.
Off to Alaska tomorrow, all right.
And you're going to catch fish?
A quick trip in pursuit of the giant halibut.
Oh, well.
I'll send a picture for you to put on the Facebook page if I get one.
I hope you do, Scott. Thanks so much for being with us today. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, emeritus professor in the Department of Wildlife, Forest and Wildlife Ecology, and UW Extension. Great to have him along. Tomorrow, our consumer protection experts will come by to talk about the latest scam and fraud alerts, and I've got a story to tell myself about a little problem I had. Thank you for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.